Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Jason.
I'm Jess.
And today, we are talking about why the internet was a huge mistake. No, we're talking about what has been termed surveillance capitalism. We're talking about the neoliberal surveillance state as it exists in both the public and private sector. And we have a good iteration, finally, of The Regrettable Century. I don't know if you guys noticed, but...
You know, what's funny is when we were introducing ourselves, you said, I'm Chris, and I was waiting. I was waiting for Kevin, and then I was like, oh no, that's not going to happen.
I should have said, Kevin, and I'm Kevin.
Rest in peace, Kevin. I wish he could be with us today.
I think that I truly believe that wherever he is, he's looking down on us and smiling.
Yeah, and disagreeing with us.
All right, so I'm going to monologue, and y'all can let me know if I do the too long didn't read at the beginning of the episode again. But so
yours is such an asset to this podcast.
Yeah, wait, we're finally good.
Yeah, finally.
Aw.
Because you're like adding structure to our fucking what is normally just three bros. They're just like, I kind of read this, but from what I understand.
We're a lot like Brack, you know, rambling idiots.
Yeah. We're just like dudes that are overconfident in what they already know and try to take on something that they fucking barely know anything about and talk about. That's what we are.
Yeah. No, normally. I do that too. Why do you think I'm so talkative during the episodes that are my idea and then we do anything else and I'm like, what's that?
Jess also is just a bro.
I tweeted something the other day where I was like, fuck, all I do now is like work out and look at my stocks. I'm no longer theory bro. I'm just bro now.
Oh shit, I forgot about your stocks.
Mm-hmm. How are your stocks doing, Jess?
Not well. Well, my crypto's doing okay. Actually, my crypto's doing pretty good.
I hate those words.
So basically we're talking about surveillance and privacy and stuff, but it has a lot to do, I think, with sovereignty. People think that like these topics are strictly related to you being caught doing crimes on camera or having like your bank information or your identity stolen, but it's more than that. Our personal identities, our preferences, our habits, our dispositions, everything down to like health data. All these personal details are aggregated into data, commodified through like manufactured consent, basically. So I don't mean to be like pithy here, but our identities are essentially stolen every day through the collection of our data. Like that's what we're surveilled for. The regular things that make up our regular personalities. So like, you know, that, aphorism, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Like, yeah. I agree with Zuboff's response to that, which is, if you have nothing to hide, you are nothing.
Most of us don't have anything to hide because we're fucking nothing.
Well, yeah. I think she means more that, like, you would basically kind of not have to exist to not have anything to hide because at this point they're taking anything.
Well, I'm choosing to read it as, if you don't do any crimes, then you are a fucking wuss.
You're a loser. Lame.
Yeah,
If you're not doing illegal shit, you're a poser.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that there's like a reticence in a certain corner of the left to talk about things like surveillance and like the aggregation of data and tech companies as something other than just media, like just in a benign sense of like Facebook and Twitter are the same as the Huffington Post. That's the thing I've actually heard someone say before. Because there is, yeah, and I think that's silly. But it's because there's a whole corner of political discourse that is like right libertarian, fear of, Big Brother, right? So anytime you talk about surveillance, you talk about security, culture, for a certain part of the left, it sounds like you have a tinfoil hat on. And it sounds like you're like some kind of Luddite, you're afraid of technology. And I would like to posit that I'm a particular kind of Luddite and I detest technology and it's different.
Well, also like most of that part of the left and that has a lot of overlap with the libertarian right is under the illusion that you can take measures to cut yourself off from surveillance and not have to exist within it, which is asinine.
it's absolutely impossible.
Yeah. Especially if you want to be effectively connected to the world that you live in.
I mean,
like, you would literally have to live in a cave.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm really not... It would take some serious convincing to me to believe that there's any way you could really disconnect from it, like, without living in a cave, like you said.
Unless you're prepared to be a communist Varg, you know?
Yes, communist Varg.
But I like taking showers too much to do that. But I do think that... you know, I think that the three people that at least that I'm aware of, one of whom I only learned about because of Jess's proposals for this discussion, right? Shoshana Zuboff, Richard Seymour, and Jody Dean are like three people on the left that I think have written intelligently about a sort of a new era that we live in that I think is under theorized and underappreciated. That basically for the last 20 years we live under a kind of a at a superstructural level, an adjustment in the regime of capital's maintenance that has a lot to do with the development of and consolidation of the use of the internet by tech monopolies. You know, so that when it comes to both state control and market dominance, there are these companies that have like a particular approach to surveillance that we don't often acknowledge as surveillance because it doesn't look the same as our imaginary version of the Stasi, right? With like secret agents in disguises, like with sitting with listening devices,
like cool surveillance,
right? Like the actual, right? Like the, but it's a much more, it's treated as benign because it's aggregating our data, and it's like, oh, it's only for market research, as if that wasn't the most insidious thing in the world.
Yeah,
as if state control was somehow bad, but market research and advertising and the utilization of your cultivated personality. And the cultivation of your personality by these tech companies wasn't at least as insidious. And honestly, it's much more horrifying to me because it's a lot harder to get our heads around.
And just like the way that people on the left sort of blow that off as a concern just really shows how thoroughly neoliberalized the left is. The most lib shit thing that anyone could do is think that advertising is benign.
We've talked about the thorough neoliberalization of the subject and the way that the left is largely just, if not exclusively, just liberal in its conception of how to engage in the world and how the left is a culture war left and that we're looking for like progressive woke companies to exercise their monopoly to their monopolistic power to do the good censorship versus the bad censorship. And we've talked about how we find that alarming, right? That it's alarming that that's a thing that people who are nominally on the left might uncritically support. But I think that the purpose of this discussion is meant to be at least the beginnings of our own attempt to figure out like why that might be, as opposed to just everyone's a fucking idiot, because I don't think that's the case. I think that there are concrete reasons, there are material reasons for these things. We're talking
there are concrete reasons, material reasons that everyone is a fucking idiot.
Right. What we're meant to do today is to gain a new appreciation for the digital superstructure over the last 20 years in the era, which has been what has probably been best to this point, best termed surveillance capitalism, but what we might instead refer to as the reign of the neoliberal surveillance state.
And then the neoliberal surveillance state, I would say, necessarily includes the private sector as well, because they are 100% like tied into the state surveillance.
Well, I was going to say, this is really actually more about the private sector than it is about state surveillance. And if anything, there's the private surveillance that affects public opinion in elections and on climate change and things like that. So,
right. And that I'm calling the private sector part of the state.
Oh, got
essentially.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because you're right. There's a mention in here about how Facebook tried to like manipulate midterm election results.
Yeah, yeah. In the 2008 election, is that when Obama got? Nope. When did Obama get elected?
That's the one.
Oh, okay. Wow. They did so much of this that there's like this quote from somebody who worked on it that was like, "We knew who was going to win before the results came out because they so heavily used." Like social media tools to like collect data and analyze data.
Okay, so Facebook in 2012 admitted to planting subliminal cues and manipulating social comparison on its pages to influence users to vote in the midterm elections and later to make them feel sad or happier.
That's not dystopian at all.
No. Researchers celebrated the success of these experiments, noted two key findings: that it was possible to manipulate online cues to influence real-world behavior and feelings, and that this could be accomplished while successfully bypassing users' awarenesses. There is this article that came out recently about the all-out blitz to influence people to vote for Biden in the 2020 election. And a heavy component of that was through targeted content on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, of which, of course, these ostensibly liberal companies aided voluntarily. And, of course, that the right took that as proof that Facebook helped steal the election for Biden. But what they lived, everything they did was perfectly legal, but they're right that it is everything in the entire system is stacked in favor of getting whichever candidate the tech companies want to get elected.
Or really any issue that is of interest in elections too. Like, I'm just gonna say this quick because it's kind of related to the election thing, but I briefly mentioned in the climate change episode about how oil companies have stopped denying climate change, but have like shifted just to influencing public opinion. And they do this largely through social media. So during elections, be it like local elections or whatever, they'll run social media operations in states where like key decisions of interest to them are going to be made. So like, for example, when I first read about this, it was a few years ago. So the data that I kind of have about it is from like 2016, but there was the oil majors like ran social media campaigns to influence ballot initiatives in several states that were voting to place fees on carbon or limit areas for oil and gas development or increase resource development. And all of these were ultimately defeated because they spend, well, I guess it's arguable whether or not this comes from their campaigns, but either way, they spend massive amounts of money on ads that reach millions of people, and they're never outright advertising. They don't mention the name Exxon or BP, but they say things like, do you support American offshore drilling? Or like, this ballot would increase energy costs and it'll eliminate whatever amount of jobs. Or, you know, like there was one in Alaska that was like, Alaskans don't need outsiders telling us what to do. So they take advantage of the general mindset of the people in that demographic and use it against them, essentially. And it seems effective.
Right. I mean, that gets to a really fundamental point about just understanding where we are in this moment, which is that whether we're talking about social media, which is just a particular variant of it, or we're talking about more generally like the tech companies like Google, Amazon, whatever else, that dominate the way that we basically experience life, right? The companies that basically organize our lives for us, they are not neutral, right? That they themselves have a political orientation. And it's not because of a particular ethics on the part of whoever owns the company. Like, it's not like Mark Zuckerberg is liberal, right? But it does happen to be the case that they have they tend to have a more comfortable institutional relationships with the Democratic Party, which is why you have a notion in sort of in conservative political discourse about the liberal media. And we always say, oh, what liberal media, right? It's like, well, no, there is a liberal media, and it's the new media.
I don't say that.
But some people do.
I found the article, and I'll put it in the show notes, the one that I was talking about, the massive voter manipulation campaign for the Biden administration.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, I think you should.
Yeah.
Because our extraordinarily limited democracy is one in which the average voter is picking which sector of capital they're rooting for. And so if you look at like who donates to the Trump campaign versus the Clinton campaign, or the Trump campaign versus the Biden campaign, it's not always a one-to-one, but you can kind of see sections of capital lining up for whoever who has a track record of ruling on their behalf as opposed to the other, right? And what's
right.
That's why Biden's a progressive. Biden's a progressive because he's not a coal guy. He's a tech guy. Not because he understands it, but because that's on whose behalf he rules. So that's the very first thing, is just we got to recognize that the tech companies, the tech monopolies are not like neutral arbiters of information access any more than the state is a neutral arbiter of like access to resources.
Right. That sort of brings up another thing that we've harped on about several occasions, is the fact that so many people on the left are totally okay with tech companies being allowed to censor what shows up on the internet. Because these tech monopolies effectively could just make sure that no one who believes a certain thing ever is allowed to say anything where anyone could ever hear it ever again, which is what happened to the Trumpist right. And of course, at the same time, a bunch of BDS groups on Facebook were purged. Some, you know, radical black nationalist groups were purged. A bunch of leftist groups were purged at the same time all of the Trumpist groups were purged. So it's like, it's the way that liberals talked about that was like, oh, well, you know, I don't know what those people were advocating, but it must have been something that tripped the algorithm. So,
which is the same thing as saying, if you don't have anything to hide, then you don't have anything to worry about.
Exactly.
If you fucking triggered the algorithm, then, you know.
Like, I guess the SWP in Britain got axed, and, they're the biggest left-wing group, radical left-wing group in the United Kingdom. They're basically the British parent group of the ISO.
Well, so that is they were once important, is what you mean.
Yeah. I think that they've fallen from grace over the past decade, but like, you know, they got zucked for God knows what, probably for BDS stuff.
You mean anti-Semitism?
Did we explain, like, what surveillance capitalism means?
We didn't.
No.
We did not.
It's a little bit what I was talking about, the way that our data is collected and moved around from, well, like, sold from company to company. I mean, usually a company doesn't necessarily sell your data, but our information is disseminated, you know, for use and fed back to us, basically, like, to intervene in our behavior and sort of This feels really tinfoil hat-like, but to tell us how to think, essentially.
No, absolutely. And act. One of the things that she talks about, Zuboff talks about, is how Facebook will sense when a customer is about to change brand loyalty and notify the advertiser to target you with a specific kind of ad to reinforce your brand loyalty.
Right. I think that the especially the op-ed in the New York Times that Zuboff wrote makes it.
Yeah.
I haven't read her books. She's written two. I mean, I'm because of having read her articles, I'm interested in her books. But she makes a pretty compelling case for there having been in the first order in the sort of the nascent development stage of what she's calling surveillance capitalism is the development of techniques, right? Software and an apparatus for aggregating data about like shopping habits, medical records, lifestyle patterns, including like travel and whatever else, political views and the media you consume and even your hopes and fears and now even like your visage, like even your actual face through like facial recognition technology to aggregate data and determine the patterns in order to better figure out who customers are as individuals and as communities and figure out how to better advertise to them. But then as the logic of capital almost inherently leads toward, why not just shift into behavioral modification, right? Because that's what advertisement's all about, actually. It's about creating demand because of supply. And so the case that she makes is that the really insidious thing about this, the thing that seems to be fairly misunderstood, is that it's not just like that Facebook or Google aggregates data based on what you do, but it also presents data to you based on what it would like you to do. It's a method of social control, which is kind of flies under the radar from the average kind of civil libertarian in their critique of the society they live in because it doesn't come from the government. But the other thing that she points to is the direct relationship between the tech monopolies and law enforcement. So that like when we talk about, and I don't think we're the only ones, but when we talk about the neoliberal surveillance state, we do literally mean state, right? Because private companies have the apparatus to do this. And then the state utilizes it through what's called a public-private partnership. So if you are somehow not horrified by your life being increasingly organized and determined by tech companies, at least you might still be horrified by the fact that those tech companies just give it all over to the police and the FBI. And they might even do something so overt as that social credit system in China that we're so afraid of, as opposed to the social credit system we have here, which doesn't have a name.
Yeah, it's just the social credit system we have here, which is primarily just our credit system.
Yeah. So she says that the goal is to automate us. And I think that we're not all that far off from getting to that point. And I think we lament this all the time when we log onto whatever social media platform and get really frustrated that everybody's talking about the same thing at any given moment. What's less clear to us is precisely how that works and precisely why that works. And Zuboff's argument is that it's all downstream of basically new markets for data. That what we're experiencing when we talk about how lamer and how more stupid everything is, and how culture is hemmed in by whatever the cultural issue of the day is, that's not just an effect of people being like on a particular social media platform. It's actually an effect of the organization of life by tech giants overall, whether you're on social media or not. And it's even to the point where so we talk about the information age and we have infinite amounts of information at our fingertips, and that's meant to be liberating, right? But when you really don't know what you're looking for and you only have a vague idea, then what's presented to you is whatever the tech company decides is most, you know, whatever's most financially useful for them to present to you. So you might get the information you're looking for, but it still is driven through a particular lens and with a particular mode in mind, which is just to say that they are not neutral because they're companies. No companies are neutral. They have an agenda, and that agenda is profit making. It isn't. Everything else is secondary to that.
I think that key to her understanding her thesis is the idea of epistemic inequality. Epistemic inequality, she says, is like the extreme asymmetry of knowledge and the power that accrues to such knowledge as a tech giant sees control of information and learning itself. So the idea that these tech companies have so much information about us, and we have no idea what that is, gives them an asymmetrical knowledge-based power over everyone in society. And she says that's like at the fundamental problem.
I was just thinking, I think I might have missed the last couple words you said, but I was just thinking when you were talking about that, like, if it's even possible, it's making the ruling class more and more powerful. I mean,
oh yeah.
I was saying to you before we got on here, the thing about like so much of the internet being hosted on Amazon servers, like this stuff is completely inescapable. Like if you wanted to try and create something that was outside of this, you almost couldn't. And I mean, I guess that's what the deep web is for, but you know, that's not exactly accessible. And also I'm sure they're going to get their hands on that somehow eventually.
The reason why this is hard to talk about is because what we're discussing and trying to assess is the organization of all of social life. When Zuboff talks about how it feels nearly impossible to withdraw from the circuits of surveillance capitalism, she refers to the atomization of social life, which is just that, like, you know, as we have talked about a lot, you know, on this podcast, is that the experience of the individual in the neoliberal era is one in which the self is constructed, and it's a myth that it is, but it's constructed in isolation, right? And so this is one of those things that connectivity through the internet is meant to sort of like sub in for social life, since it doesn't exist in the form of whether it's a church or political party or some whatever civic institution. The internet subs in for that, so it makes it hard to unplug. The other one is the digitization of knowledge. Like, it just happens to be the case that it is easier to seek out everything that you're trying to research, whether it's for pleasure or it's professional or it's political or whatever it is. You could just find everything that you want to find on the internet, and you can just use the search engine to find it. The fact that only helps reinforce the total dominance of tech companies over your life is, you know, it's lamentable, and a lot of people, you know, we know about it in at least a casual abstract sense, we're aware of it. But like, what am I going to do instead? Drive across town to go to the library and get one book on the subject instead of having infinite amounts of data on the subject right here on my laptop? The third one is about maintaining competitiveness in the labor markets. Like, you just actually do have to be online. And in some professions, you actually have to have a social media profile, or you at least have to have like a LinkedIn or something. You know, that's sort of less and less popular, but it's harder and harder to be aware of what jobs you're trying to get. but also marketable in those jobs if you're not relatively plugged in to the internet. And then the last one, which is the one that's most easily lampooned, maybe the hardest to figure out how to get away from, is just the purely addictive nature of it. And again, not just about social media, that's the easiest one to point to. It's also the most, it's maybe the most insidious one, because that's the one that is lab perfected to be addictive, right? But yeah. But just the internet overall. When was the last time you went a day without being online?
Online? Yeah,
like at all.
Like, what's about maybe 20 years ago?
Exactly. It's not just like you need to do it like in the way that you need to go to a job, because otherwise you won't have a paycheck and you'll starve to death. You need to do it like in the way that you need to have that next cigarette. Your whole life is so, it's so, you're so completely used to living this way that there's no, you can't unplug from it.
It's impossible to unplug from it. Like, the entire world is functions through the internet. So, I mean, even if you wanted to, you couldn't.
Right.
But how about, when was the last time you totally unplugged from social media and didn't look at it at all?
Oh, I mean, much more recently, like a couple days ago.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
But the point is that, like, this is where I think Zuboff's argument starts to run out of steam. Because if that's true, and I do think she's right, that the atomization of social life, the digitization of knowledge, the need for competitiveness in the labor market, and the like incomprehensibly addictive nature of the structures of surveillance capitalism. Because of those things, I don't believe that regulation focused on tech is possible. I mean, she says it's doomed because we need to, like, you know, there are all these questions about consent and agency on the part of the individual voter, right? But she believes in democracy in a sort of abstract way. I think regulation is doomed, period, in the same way I think the Paris Climate Accords and the Green New Deal is doomed. Because these things have become so central to our lives that they have to become public utilities. So, it seems to me, the answer to surveillance capitalism is still just communism.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to relate it back to the climate change thing, too. It feels very similar to me that this is something that's, like, too powerful to be regulated at this point. Oh, can I just point out how in, I think, the New York Times article, Zuboff says something like, you no longer search for Google. Google searches for you.
I mean, it's true.
I know. But just putting it that way, I was like, ooh.
Yeah, that's definitely like that's a reference for a generation that remembers Yakov Smirnov.
Yeah, I read it in that voice.
It's funny. Okay, so in this part of the article, when she's talking about how people are starting to get fed up with this idea and are seeing it as negative, in fact, she says that like 81% of Americans believe that potential risks of computer data collection outweigh the benefits. So that, first of all, puts the lie to the idea that this is not coercion somehow, that people are willingly acquiescing to existing in this surveillance state. I mean, they are willingly acquiescing to it because they don't realize that they are. Whenever they click, yes, I agree to this, you know, this user agreement or whatever, they realize that they don't realize that what they're doing is completely agreeing to surveillance constantly, or by carrying around your iPhone in your pocket, right? Which listens to everything you say and puts all of that information into their fucking gigantic, the big bucket of information that they have up there in the sky, the tubes from the to, you know? So people don't really realize in a lot of cases that what they're doing is agreeing to the surveillance. But when put to the question, they're like, yeah, I don't agree with that. That's bad. It is not a good thing. I'm against that. It's 81% of people. Who the fuck are the other percentage? Are they like people that work for Amazon and Google or what? But anyway, like she says that, you know, doing something like outlawing human futures markets would eliminate financial incentives that sustain the surveillance dividend, and outlawing the idea that a company can claim the right to your face or use your face as free raw material for analysis. Okay, so those are things that she says would break the back of surveillance capitalism. That would no longer be, surveillance capitalism would no longer have any hold. But at this point, to me, it seems like after she says all this stuff about the burgeoning usefulness for political control, as is exhibited by the Cambridge Analytica breach and Facebook doing its experiments on getting people out to vote, it seems as though that the political will to do something like this is not going to exist on its own. And with 81% of people saying it's a bad thing and then still opting in for it, there's no political will on the ground either. So she tries to strike a note of hope, but I'm here to you know.
I'm here to take a shotgun and aim it right at that little beacon of hope.
She's right that those things probably would break the back of surveillance capitalism, this just enormous, all-consuming, profitable industry that controls everything. But we're going to have the Communist Revolution before that happens.
Yeah. Look, so there are two reasons why I think we shouldn't exclusively focus on the work of this one person. Although I do think that she's great.
No, she
is great.
In terms
of analysis, right? Shoshana Zuboff is somebody people should be familiar with. And I want to become more familiar with.
She's done a wonderful autopsy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But we need the fucking miracle worker to teach us how to raise the dead.
Well, right. So that's why I think that it's lucky that the other two names, that at least that I'm aware of, that are trying to figure out this question are Jody Dean and Richard Seymour. Because they come directly out of the communist tradition and they are on different... They have different positions, right? But these are both party people. These are both people who have not given up on the central thesis that you know, the capitalist state is a state of capitalists. It's not a neutral arbiter, and it rules on behalf of and influenced by private capital, like the companies that are the tech companies, but also other ones. And that means that it has to be like overthrown. And in order to do that, you can't have a disaggregated resistance, which literally mirrors the disaggregated social life, which has been given to us by that state and those tech companies. This means we need a political party, we need a workers' party, and we need the organization of labor in the direct opposition to that disaggregating, exploitative, labor regime. So, but we have talked on this podcast about the desire to be pointing towards something more than just everything we lament about the horrendous state of our awful, terrible world.
I have that desire. I just don't know how to manifest
it. Right. So, you know, it's because usually it's in the realm of fantasy. But one fantasy that I'm willing to entertain publicly is that as we're building the elemental structures of the party, you know, when we get around to doing that, we will, with any luck at all, we will be recruiting class-conscious, low-paid, and middle-tier tech workers who know how to build these awful systems which currently organize our lives, so that we can have some proprietary software for the Workers' Party, so that we don't do our, you know, long-distance meetings via Zoom or whatever platform, and we don't organize our internal discussion boards via Slack or Discord or whatever platforms, and that we don't ever use Twitter again as a political tool or Facebook as a political tool, but that we develop our own versions of these encrypted open-source versions of these, where your party membership also comes with your login, and it can be revoked when your membership becomes revoked because, you know, we'll have a party which has discipline built into it, right? I don't know how to do that, but I also don't know how to run I don't know how to work at the Suez Canal, but it's very clear that the people who do could stop a huge part of the world economy by organizing a strike there. So there's an argument here that tech workers actually have an incredibly important role, political role to play in the future. But not if we have a left which does somehow regard Amazon, Google, Facebook, Twitter as also our tools.
You remember, like, around the time of the Arab Spring, this is when it really sort of reached fever pitch, the idea that the internet was going to democratize everything.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that existed since the late 90s. I remember hearing it the whole time. But all the way up to, you know, the Arab Spring. It's like, oh, this seed, look, now everyone's relying on independent media. This is what we've been needing is like info shops on the internet for everyone to log into and get the real news. And we can organize everything through Facebook. And remember the just unbridled optimism about the democratization of society through the internet?
I do. And I, you know, I was a child in the 90s, but I am aware that like you said, that there was a previous version of this.
Right. And I don't remember that one that much, but I definitely remember the one around the Tahrir Square organizing.
Right. It basically seems to me like it amounts to a yearning for a shortcut. Because when we look around, what we don't see is a militant trade union movement and a corresponding militant workers' party. So we're like, well, okay, what else we got? You know, it's like, well, we can raise awareness, you know, we can uplift marginalized voices, right? Like, it's not, you know, I know I always sound like I think everybody's a dunce, but what I really mean to say is that, like,
this is self-criticism.
We are
This is all self-criticism. Right. I think I want everyone to understand that about us. It's like, we're talking this shit because we're talking about ourselves.
Right, this...
iterations of ourselves that used to be.
Right, know? Speaking as a former dunce myself, I can say.
Yeah. I'm still a fucking dunce, just not about this.
But this is that kind of like, really, this does get down to, this does bring us back around to the basic ethic that's at the heart of why we do this podcast in the first place, about an embrace of our actual pessimism as opposed to a forced optimism. Because that forced optimism right. sounds like, I don't care what's happening, I know we'll win. It's like, no, I actually care a lot about what's happening, because if what's happening keeps happening, we will not win. I am extremely pessimistic about all second and third and fourth place ideas for how to achieve the social transformation necessary to make life on this planet worthy of the name life. And the answer is still always revolution, and that still always means the working class. And so what this discussion really is about getting back around to the recognition that the utopia that they you know, gave us in place of the bold new world that was we were supposed to be born into is actually a dystopia. Whether it's the... You know, the Wild West internet of the 90s, I could see why there's a certain kind of person who saw that as like a potential space for a more, if not emancipated life, then at least a more liberated space for information. But that doesn't exist anymore.
No, I mean, there was a window there where it sort of existed, right? Before they figured out how to optimize search results to never show you anything that they didn't want you to
see. Yeah, exactly. I'm a researcher by trade, and I can tell you, it used to be easier to use the internet.
Oh, right. Like, I mean, you know, I research constantly for graduate school, and essentially the only tools that are of any use are the ones that I can only access through my institution, because Google is a piece of shit. It just shows you whoever pays the most for whatever thing wants you to see. Yeah. If you want to get to good information, you've got to search through other sources. Google is useless. I remember, like, whenever I was an undergrad, I could type in the subject that I wanted to search for and PDF, mm-hmm. and then there would just be like an enormous list of PDFs that I could choose from.
Yeah, and not that I think we necessarily anybody needs examples of this because it's very clear, but I was just thinking about how at some point, like, I don't know, early in the pandemic, I saw something on Twitter, which unfortunately sometimes has better news than other places. Someone had tweeted something about how good Cuba's response to the pandemic was. And I was like, I'd like to yell about that on the internet, so I should go look up some facts about that. And I tried Googling it and virtually could not find an article about it, except like some shitty one that was titled like Cuba's making these employees give up their clothes or something. And then it was actually an article about the way that they were like repurposing clothes for something. Yeah. So Google sucks. I also just realized, by the way, that I have this book right here called Automation and the Future of Work that I probably should have read for this episode.
Oh, me and my homies hate automation.
Well, doesn't Fove imply that, like, we're scared of it?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe that's not correct, but, like, I'm full... It's not some kind of, like, boomerish thing where I don't understand it, so I won't fuck with it. I mean, I use TikTok, for God's sake. Like, I will fuck with anything. I don't care how old I am. Like, I'm not scared of it, and it's not that I don't understand it. I'm just all too aware of everything we've been talking about. Like, it's fucking scary, for real. And I don't know if we've really gone into sort of a further, and maybe we haven't, I already forgot, but like a further discussion here of the psychological effects of this, because that really is the scariest part. And usually when people talk about that, they only talk about that in terms of like social media and like how it's breaking our brains, that we have to get serotonin boosts from likes. But there's way more to it than that. I don't know, maybe we already went into it enough when we were talking about the way that they're trying to shape our behaviors with this.
We mentioned it in passing that Facebook did experiments to see if they could manipulate people's, to first of all, to get out to vote, mm-hmm. just to see if they could do that. And that definitely plays towards their political interests. Well, actually, it plays to their political interests if the old adage that if more people vote, then they'll vote Democrat. which we have found out this last election cycle isn't necessarily true. Whoops. But, yeah. But, and they manipulated people to see if they can make them happy or sad. And as a social experiment to see if they could do it. Turns out they can. One of the things that this article by Zuboff in the New York Times also talked about was how Pokemon Go, they would direct people to businesses that paid them.
Yep. I played Pokemon
to
Go.
To direct them there.
Extensively.
Yeah,
you can advertise on there. Like all the Starbucks are, you know, paid for. The Pokestops are paid for by Starbucks. And when you spend the little thing, there's like a picture of a Frappuccino on there.
Yeah. And so it was actually a very successful way to drive people into these businesses. And they consented to it. You know, and through that, it was also a data gathering scheme as well as a scheme to direct people to doing things. But, yeah, so these are just very small, tiny ways that we know that companies, not the government, companies are attempting to influence our behavior in specific ways. And of course, this article also talks about how supply and demand, of course, we know is bullshit. It doesn't mean anything in capitalism. That demand is created and the supply is, you know, created to meet that demand. And that this is the most insidious way of doing that. If you can literally manipulate people's emotions and predict patterns of behavior, then you can manipulate people through showing whatever you show them through the usage of social media and whatever else into purchasing the things you want, into leaving the house, into going to a specific area of town at a specific time of day. And it's all with the nominal consent of the people involved. It's actually incredibly terrible.
Yeah. And also, I think that a lot of people, you know, particularly maybe on the left, because we all think we're so smart, would like to think like, oh, this behavior modification, like this doesn't happen to me. This is like dumb people. But if you really think hard about it, there's absolutely got to be examples in your life of times that your self somehow has been influenced by something you saw online. Like I've been trying to think of an example because I'm sure there are some, but like, I know for a fact that things online, whether they're advertising or not, can change the way I feel about something. Like, for instance, if I see all my stupid hyper-lib friends talking about something and having a dumb opinion about it, I know that I disagree with that thing. I'm just kidding. But, like, you know, like, you do...
If all the libs are excited about it, I'm like, ooh.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. But, I mean...
That's why I'm not excited about AOC.
Yeah. But it's just like nobody is outside this. Like, you just can't deny that your thoughts and feelings are very much influenced by social media, by the things that you see on there and experience.
I will say that, like, ever since I deleted my social media apps off of my phone, that they don't know what the fuck to target me with anymore. Like, my ads are fucking weird now. Like, whenever I log into Facebook online, it's just totally random. They must rely a lot on location and voice.
But also, I was just thinking about that dumbass Vice article that I didn't like, obviously, but it was pointing out as they were interviewing whatever fucking dolt that was they were interviewing, who was pointing out essentially like, yeah, your phones do actually listen to you. And I mean, I know this is such like a boring conversation. I feel like I have the like, oh, yeah, I was talking about this, and then my phone showed me that. Isn't that crazy? Like, I feel like this has become, like, regular small talk. But the thing that was kind of interesting about that article is this guy was like, yeah, we know that these companies have some, like, triggers set on your phone to start paying attention when you say something, and we don't know what they are, but it's there. And, I mean, of course, the article ended with him being like, it's MBD, though. And Vice was like, yeah, like, if you're not a journalist or a lawyer, then MBD.
It's fucking Vice, man.
It's, yeah, but it's there. Like, that really happens. It's not a joke. It's not just a joke. Like, I was actually just thinking as we were talking about this, I'm like, I wonder if I opened Instagram right now, if there'd be something somehow related to what we're talking about. I'm gonna see.
Let's find out. Let's all conduct up my experiment real quick.
I opened up my Facebook topics that it targets you for ads, and it was like black entrepreneurship. But yeah, I guess me deleting the apps off my phone must be fucking with their algorithms a little bit.
I got a GIF of Stalin on my Explore page.
Yeah, so yours is still pretty. It's still pretty accurate.
Yeah, can't trick them.
So, okay, I do want to talk about this phenomenon of the growing awareness and distaste for the way in which we live in an extremely totalitarian society, and that people know it.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, you know, you'll have the meme about the, like, it'll be a text, and someone's like, oh, I've always had a crush on you, and then the text, the response is like, oh, you know, oh my god, I've always had a crush on you, and then there's like a cartoon of like a guy with a hat that says FBI and he's like crying happy tears and a guy's high-fiving him behind that, and it's like, we all know, right? It's so fucking banal that we are under constant surveillance that we make jokes about our FBI agents all the time, and that sounds like consent, honestly. You know, I know that we think that that consent means I like sign a form that says I consent, even though of course you have to sign the form because you don't have an alternative route. Anyways, but it doesn't mean that. It actually, what consent looks like, you know, when you have no power, is it looks like this. It looks like we've just sort of adapted. And because what else are we supposed to do? Like, in the absence of a meaningful vehicles for struggle to topple the institutions of surveillance, of domination, right? Of the rule of capital and the commodity form over our lives, what else is there to do other than just make jokes about how we're all fucking doomed? And we live in a terrible totalitarian society. And here's a meme.
Yeah. It still just has so much in common with the climate change thing to me. Which is also ironic, considering that the internet itself is making climate change worse. But I guess that's a little off topic here.
it's all the same goddamn problem, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me, I've been reading a lot about soldiers in World War I and their coping mechanisms for being in combat, and one of the ways that they stay sane was just by making jokes constantly about how they're all going to die.
Yeah,
there's like there's a direct correlation between your ability to joke about the terrible things that are happening to you and your ability to stay sane.
That was a point that you made before. I forget when now, but you had said that the irony is a coping mechanism, and like
irony is good, actually.
Right. And so this generation's extreme, what we call irony poisoning, right? Is indicative of just how traumatized we are in a real sense, in the sense of what that word actually means, by just existing in this hyper-atomized, hyper-alienated life of just utter fucking powerlessness, you know, which is just the boots so pressed firmly against your neck to the point of leaving like a permanent imprint.
Well, let's stick with the topic of like hyper-individualized alienation, right? The reason why surveillance capitalism is able to just fly under the radar, I mean, it's not even under the radar. Everyone understands what's going on. At least it has a broad outline of what's going on in their heads, right? The reason why it's able to continue with just this basic level of consent, which is just born from neglecting to say anything or do anything about it, is the fact that no one can envision their lives without, like, there could never be any prospect of a strike within these institutions, because we, first of all, don't have any kind of organization within them, nor do we have the will or ability to boycott them.
Yeah.
You know, how do you boycott social media when that is your only method of interaction with the world? And it's even worse during COVID, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do you withdraw your consent from something? There's no way to do it. Like in a hyper alienated society where we don't have churches anymore, we don't have like fraternal societies, and under COVID we don't even have group hangouts. How do you cut yourself off from the last bit of socialization that you have? You know, I saw an article recently about how church attendance is down, and people are saying, "Oh, that's a good, you know, organized religion is dying." But is it though? Is it really good? If something that we think is bad. And I'm not saying that I think organized religion is bad, but if something that like people think is bad is going away on its own, while the world's getting worse, you really think that has anything to do with anything we've done?
Yeah,
you know,
that's. Yeah. I'm not going to count that as a win.
Let's say that you think that religion is nothing but a mechanism for control, right?
Let's act like it's the 18th century, and you are a radical Democrat in the 18th century. Yeah.
Well, let's act like the reason that homophobia exists is because there are churches. Religion is a mechanism for control. Now, if that mechanism for control is just going away on its own, what does that tell you about society? About the society that you live
in? It's being...
It should tell you that the mechanism of control is something else.
Yeah. Right, it should say that that mechanism is historically irrelevant as a mechanism for control.
Which is why I maintain that religion isn't a fucking problem. In fact, at this point, it's positive.
Oh shit, are you saying that religion has been alpha-bunked?
Yeah, religion has been alpha-bunked. It can be positive. Clearly, it's not all positive, but it can be positive. It can be a center of community and a center of resistance, even, you know, depending on which fucking iteration you're talking about.
And there's the camp of people who, instead of necessarily thinking religion is bad, are like, well, I think it's dumb, but if it helps them feel better, then more power to them, or whatever. Like, yeah, so if the people who usually feel better from religion don't feel that way anymore, shit's bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know what happens, like, you know, the whole gateway drug, like, trope, right? Is like, once that drug doesn't do it for you anymore, you move on to harder drugs, right? So if people are moving on from this thing, which you regard as so bad, but at least it makes people feel good, how much fucking worse is the next thing gonna be?
Yeah.
What are people moving on from?
What's...
That's right.
Well, the cults are personalities on the internet. And the religion is defending attacking their enemies.
Weird ass religion. There's weird ass cults around people like Elon Musk, or like, you know, and there could be at least a few people who find this to be distasteful. But Cardi B, who I'm sorry, is not one of us. It's not.
Do you mean white people?
Yes, white people fucking love Cardi B. Cardi B is not our Che Guevara. You know, we haven't got one.
Right.
That's the problem.
Cardi B is a pop star who has some woke opinions sometimes.
Yeah, you know who else has some woke opinions? Fucking everyone. Every head of every company has some woke opinions. Except for Chick-fil-A, and I guess it's radical if you eat a different chicken sandwich. But I know that what we're trying to talk about is we have an immense social problem in the form of tech monopolies, which determine our lifestyles and habits, and thus determines our death styles. Shit, okay, it might be too late for me to be doing this too. oh, shit, okay.
Okay, no, we could talk about that for a second. That the idolization of celebrities or internet stars or whatever is very much part of all of this. And ad revenue is driven by their ability to keep people involved. So now let's say some internet celebrity or some celebrity has a negative opinion that has them lose subscribers, right? That means that the profit motive for advertising on those pages is going to go down. So if you're a leftist that has a big following on the internet, like on YouTube or something like that, and your videos that are at all monetized,
doesn't that mean that you're necessarily in thrall to the system as it is currently constructed? That's the question. And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
The relationship between celebrity and, let's just keep using the term surveillance capitalism, is something that the analysis of which, at least in its earliest forms, goes back to the 60s, right? Like, Debord talked about this in The Society of the Spectacle. And the celebrity is the spectacular representation of, like, all that is possible, you know, in the world of the commodity form. He says, celebrities exist to act out various styles of living and viewing society unfettered and free to express themselves globally. They embody the inaccessible result of social labor by dramatizing its byproducts, magically projected above it as its goal. And that was the role of celebrity in the era of mass media as a one-way project, right, where you sit in front of the television or in front of the radio or in front of the movie screen, and you have the image projected toward you to shape, you know, to shape your consciousness. But in this era, right, in the era of tech companies, which give you a platform, whether it's a Twitter or a Facebook or an Instagram or a Medium or whatever your particular platform is, everybody gets to at least compete in the marketplace to become their own celebrity. The ultimate spectacular person isn't the celebrity anymore. It's the average consumer of celebrity in the process of trying to make themselves into celebrity. It is the byproduct of the complete dominance of our lives by media/tech companies.
And what I was trying to say earlier,
before I was so rudely interrupted,
but
we'll see.
So I remember one time I watched, back when like VH1 did the Behind the Music or whatever, I watched one about Huey Lewis.
And you don't want to watch that? That sounds great.
And he said that he called his dad one day to tell him, "Hey, Dad, you know, my fucking single's number one, and you know, we're making shitloads of money, and everyone really likes us." And he's like, his dad was like, "Oh, I haven't heard it." And he's like, "Well, what do you mean? You haven't listened to my music?" He's like, "No, if it's something that everybody likes, it can't possibly be any good." That kind of made me think about popular leftist celebrities.
Mm.
Like, if what you were saying was any good, they wouldn't let you say it.
You know, this is always ultimately a criticism of the left, which is to say a criticism of ourselves, ultimately. Because we're only ever going to be as good as the best part of our section, right? But we can't rely on, and we shouldn't rely on, and we actually ought to be extremely skeptical of the celebrities in our midst, in the creation of celebrity, and the tendency towards celebrity, and the desire to be celebrity, because all of that is something which has been... Those are all parameters which are defined for us by a social order, which we utterly detest. And a particular variant of it, a particular corner of that social order, which is the liberal one. That's the one that runs... I don't care how much of a problematic Red Brown it makes me, there is a liberal media. I work in it. I know them.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is sort of the synthesis of all of this, or an attempt at it anyways, is that what we're calling surveillance capitalism, the era of the neoliberal model of aggregating and monetizing data as a method of social control outright, is part and parcel to the exact same structures of that society, which present to us celebrity figures as both a model of the embodiment of our desires in the form of our lifestyle, because they get to live fancy lives and they get to be famous and they get to whatever, do things we don't get to do because we're not wealthy and nobody gives a shit what we think. But also, these are the people who give us our opinions. And so we're looking around for saviors all the time for a reason, because that same society, right, that same organization of our lives is the one which is the result of the obliteration of our trade unions and the obliteration of, you know, every dissenting section, any organized dissent in this society against capital, right? It is muted dissent and made it into something that when there is dissent, it's something that which is palatable on the red carpet and palatable in the CIA's recruitment campaigns and palatable, you know, in Wells Fargo's, you know, pride parade float. But real dissent doesn't have any celebrity figures, because real dissent, real communism, you know, real opposition to capitalism is something which you just can't monetize. You can't. If it's a real threat, then it's not going to be famous.
Right. Like Huey Lewis's dad said.
Like, ultimately, that's what we're really about, is we're about Huey Lewis Senior. I just assume everyone in that family has that name. What
the fuck? Hubert Lewis Senior.
Hubert Lewis is the dad.
Yeah.
You know, I had a whole bit in my mind about the Luddites. Like, we have this historical memory of the Luddites, and, like, being a Luddite is, like, an insult, because Luddites were these revanchist, reactionary opponents of progress, whatever. And honestly, like, that's unfair, because what the Luddites were actually doing is resisting domination, right? They were resisting the decline in their standard of living, because in their security in life, and that which gave them any sense of power, which is their ability, you know, the ownership over the means of production that they had, right? Their ability to control and decide what was going to happen. So when they resisted, and when they broke up the machines, which were coming in and changing their labor regime, they were resisting the atomizing, scattering effects, the disempowering effects of the development of a more consolidated capitalist regime. That's precisely the spirit that we should embody.
Yeah, the Luddites did
nothing wrong. The Luddites did nothing wrong. The kind of person who says Luddite as an insult is the same kind of person who worships fucking technology and thinks we can somehow fully automate luxury communism. And it's wrong.
The impulse that the Luddites had to resist domination was absolutely the correct impulse. And history has borne out how correct they were. What we've done instead of listening to the Luddites is destroy the fucking planet.
Right.
Okay, so if society could have developed without the domination of the capitalists over the Luddites, then we would be living in a much better world right now. And that's something I'm, as I get older, I'm more and more opening to discussing. And whereas previously I would have just been like, no, capitalism was a positive development. I mean, I think that, like, since it has turned out that capitalism is probably going to end up destroying the planet before the communists have their chance to do anything about it, that I guess it wasn't.
Yeah.
Do I get kicked out of Marxism for saying that?
I mean, you would get kicked out of Marxism alongside Federici. So I know that's not the company you would prefer to keep, but at least you won't be entirely alone.
Oh.
There was one other thing I meant to bring up, but we didn't have any reading about it, and I only know as much about it as I am pretty much going to say in this sentence, but I feel like you said something about Elon Musk, and I was thinking earlier about Neuralink and how that's actually the scariest thing that is, like, on the horizon of all. Like, Marx failed to account for Elon Musk's Neuralink. That is some scary shit. Like, that will literally be advertising inside our consciousness.
Yeah, I won't be around for that.
I mean, I'm not sure, really. I think it's probably one of those things where we're really not all that close, realistically, to being able to do that. But considering how fast everything progresses, who fucking knows?
Well, that's actually a point of contention, based on the stuff that we've been reading recently, for me, is...
Which part is a point of contention?
How that stuff is moving quickly. I would say that, like, that we don't actually have much as far in the form of innovation, technologically.
I mean, sort of, but I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I think a lot of development happens in AI and machine learning, and I think those are separate things. And in generally, I guess, all of, like, computer science, like, all the time.
Right, but what are the qualitatively enormous jumps that have happened recently? Like, look, like, okay, like David Graeber said this, between 1900 and 1969, the maximum speed for a human being went from, like, 27 miles an hour to 40,000 miles an hour. And then it plateaued there. And then, you know, we went to the moon, we created computers, we did all this stuff. And now what we've had every year for the past 20 years is a new version of this.
Yeah, but think about how much worse everything we've been talking about has been getting every year. And that's in the last 20 right. years.
Right. And all of the innovation that has been happening is just rehashing technology that already exists. So
yeah, but it's like it's faster, like, and smarter versions of it.
Right. There's no great leaps of, like, technological advancement that are happening. There's, like, minuscule recalculations accumulating.
I wouldn't call them minuscule, but even if they were, they add up to something.
No one's saying that advancements aren't being made. It's just that we have lost the capacity for gigantic advancements and for, like, great innovation.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, I disagree with that.
Well, so, like, I think this is a good scale to look at it. So, like, in 1900, the overwhelming majority of people get around by horses. Horse-drawn carriages. That's how people...
Walking or some animal.
Right. Now, there are steam power trains, right? Of course, those exist, right? But then by 1950, most people have access to a car. Or we can ride a bus, right? Actually revolutionizes our lives in the course of 50 years. And then 50 years from there, literally nothing has changed about how we get around. And if you want to, like, add in that space of time, the distance between the, right, from the Wright brothers in 1911 to the creation of the Boeing 747 is the same amount of time since the Boeing 747 was invented and mass produced, which is still the primary way that people travel around the world. And it's Air Force One, the model for the most important person in the world to travel around in, is the same plane, because our leaps in technological development are smaller and less frequent. Like, the 20th century, well, really, it's from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century, was an uninterrupted sequence of immense revolutionizing of technology on all fronts. And then, since then, we've had shorter and shorter leaps, smaller and smaller developments, a plateauing of technological advancement is maybe not the best way to put it, because that sounds like we're at stasis. There's just less. There's less technological development.
Yeah, and when I said the speed record was like 27 miles an hour and 40,000 miles an hour, it's 40 miles an hour and like 25,000 miles an hour.
But it isn't. We shouldn't discount nanotechnology, though. Like, nanotechnology is really significant. It's like, it is a major leap in technological achievement. It's just one of very few.
I feel like I'm stuck on this because I'm so stuck on AI, and maybe someone who listens to this podcast who, like, knows more about this than me is going to be like, this bitch should shut up because AI is not that big of a deal. But I'm pretty sure it is. And especially because even if we don't have advancements in anything else, if just AI continues to develop the way it does, it's going to have so many effects, both bad and good. Like, first of all, AI is kind of at the root of everything we've been talking about this whole episode. So it's going to destroy our fucking brains.
That's true.
But there'll be sometime in the meantime, hopefully there should be development in, I mean, the better AI gets, the better anything that runs on AI is, which is, I don't know, a lot of things. But also, I'm not trying to be like, oh, I think they're going to turn into like RoboCop, like real robots. But there's something really scary there to me.
Look, honestly, if there is anything that I am actually genuinely concerned about, it is RoboCops, right? And I don't necessarily mean like the one from the movie, but the automation of the utilization of AI for law enforcement. You know, there's a lot of discussion about like figuring out who is going to be a criminal before they commit a crime. It was just not the same as like 19th century race science, but it's because it's somehow more woke, but it's basically the same thing, right? I actually, to say that we've had a slowdown in technological development is not to say that there is no technological development.
That's the thing, though, is like, AI development is 95% through the Pentagon. So it all has to do with probably surveillance or unmanned drones and stuff like that. It's all how to kill. So that right there is the caveat. Progress has stagnated except for in ways to kill.
Yeah, like, you know, when you play Civilization V and you get to the era where you're researching future techs, the only new unit you can build is called Gigantic Death Robot. I don't want to get there in real life.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that Graeber mentions in this article, too, is that funding levels are astronomical by comparison to back when these gigantic leaps and bounds of technological development were being made. It's just like the amount of money that is being put in for what is coming out. You know, I'm in a history of Nazi Germany and World War II class, but my professor is a professor of military history. So he was actually talking about government waste as far as military technology is concerned, and how they pretty much are scrapping a lot of futuristic tech to just revamp old tech. So he was saying that they're scrapping the new jet fighter that's...
Oh, the F-35.
Yeah, that they've been working on for like 30 years.
$1 trillion fucking boondoggle.
To bring back better versions of the F-15. And that military technology is plateaued as well. Where they're having success is in drones. So everything is being channeled into drones.
Yeah. So that is, you know, the automation side of technological development is, that's the future for the reserve army of the unemployed to grow to greater and greater size, but never to be replaced, because they're not going to replace human beings doing work.
No.
They're just going to make it so that, I mean, look, I said this before, the future that we're facing is the future that Jack London talks about in The Iron Heel. Hidden in the